everybody. What is going on? I hope everyone is doing well, enjoying their summer, and welcome back yet again to a brand new episode of Sweeten Up Podcast, season number 3, episode number 97. We've been off for the last couple weeks. As I've said before, a lot of the folks who work on this show, who dedicate a lot of their time to make this show what it is, all work full-time jobs, including myself, and we've been so busy this summer with that, but we are so glad to finally be back once again for a brand new podcast episode, and we're glad to have you as well. I am your host, Jeff Spencer, and thank you so much for taking some time to join me today. I greatly appreciate it, whether you have for multiple seasons, an entire year, or you are today for the first time. Thank you so much for joining us. If you are just joining us for the first time, take a look back at our library of 96 episodes anytime you want, anywhere you listen to your podcasts. As always, if you like what you hear on the podcast today and you want to hear more, please be sure to tell all your friends and subscribe to the show anywhere you get your podcasts so that you never miss a future episode. The podcast is available on all major podcast platforms, and you can find us on Instagram and Facebook. Just search for Sweeten Up Podcast. With that being said, today's episode is part number one of my two-part conversation with the great and powerful Bob Florence. Bob Florence is the founder and co-owner of Maromi, a company based in beautiful coastal southeastern Connecticut, creating handcrafted seasonings based on traditional fermentation techniques using koji and our natural microbiome to transform a variety of local ingredients into unique sauces, seasonings, and condiments. As a chemist, Bob has had a lifelong passion for making stuff. Having lived and worked throughout the United States, Mexico, and Asia, Bob left the corporate world and settled in Mystic, Connecticut, to mindfully slow down and focus on developing unique, handcrafted seasonings, including soy sauce, miso, and fermented hot sauces. Bob studied the art of shoyu making under the guidance of his mentors at Chiba Shoyu in Japan. We talked about it all from the beginning until what he's up to now. Bob is one of the most interesting folks I've had a chance to get to talk to, and you're really going to enjoy this conversation. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, here he is, my friend, and part one of my two-part conversation with one of the most interesting guys around, the great Bob Florence. Joining me on the podcast today via Zoom video conferencing, coming at us from beautiful North Stonington, Connecticut, it is an absolute pleasure and honor to have this esteemed gentleman on the other side of my computer screen. He is a chemist developing unique handcrafted seasonings, including soy sauce, miso, and fermented hot sauces, the owner and co-founder of Maromi, located right here in Mystic, Connecticut, the great and powerful Bob Florence joins the program today. And Bob, thank you so much for joining the Sweeten Up Podcast. I really, really appreciate it. It's great to see you. And how are you doing, my friend? What's going on this evening?
Hey, Jeff. Thanks for the invite. I really appreciate it. It's a lot of fun. I don't think anyone's ever called me great and powerful. So that's just a great kickoff for the evening. Thanks. Yeah. Wonderful to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. That's a phrase that I've coined here on the show that was coined before me. I was, of course, a huge fan many years ago of the Joe Rogan podcast when he first got going, before Spotify and everything like that. And he calls all his guests, at least he did then. I don't know if he still does because I kind of fallen out of touch. But he called all his guests the great and powerful. And that was one of the first podcasts I started listening to. So when I started mine as an ode to Joe Rogan, I call all my guests the great and powerful. But I mean it. They really are the great and powerful. And you're doing a lot of incredible things, and I'm so incredibly inspired by your background and how you've decided to sort of shift focus from what you were doing early on to what you're doing today with Maromi. And I think that's super, super cool, because you're taking on a big challenge with learning how to ferment and everything like that, which I heard on a recent podcast you're on. So I can't wait to dive into all of it. But before I get there, 4th of July was literally yesterday. So what I would like to ask you is, how was your 4th of July? How was your weekend? Was there something you were up to, and what could you tell us?
Well, thanks for asking. So actually I worked this weekend. So no, I, I, um, So I kind of run a one-man show, if you will. So I'm fermenting constantly, and all those fermenting barrels need a lot of attention. So I really don't get too far away from any weekend. So part of the weekend I do that, and then part of the weekend I take care of the garden. I gotta consider, I turned all my grass into garden. So when I bought my place here in Mystic, I had a lawn. And then the first season that we were here, I turned the front yard into a cornfield. And my wife Debbie, she's like, "What are you doing?" We don't need grass, so we're gonna grow food. So I've been working we've been here for about 10 years. So I've been working on gradually converting every inch of the yard from grass to food and flowers.
Wow, that is really cool. I got to tell you, that's cool. That's a first here. I haven't heard that yet, but that's awesome. I love that aspect. I mean, now you don't have to mow the lawn and you're getting something out of it at the same time.
I still have some patches of lawn, but they're gradually disappearing. So every year I sort of take over another little piece, and I go, "Oh, you know what would look good there?" So it's a little bit of turning into a little bit of a jungle, but we've got a wonderful now monarch butterfly garden with a lot of milkweed growing. So we've got a lot of butterflies. We don't use any chemicals or pesticides or anything, totally chemical free. So a lot of things thrive. The soil's real healthy. We get a lot of worms and stuff growing in the soil. So what I've noticed over the tenure that we've had the place is just the produce that we produce on a very small piece of property is, it's just incredible. It's really tasty. It's really healthy. And we really don't battle bugs because we have birds and sort of a nice balance here on the property. So it's nice, Jeff. Yeah. So that's what I do on the weekend. Thanks for asking.
Wow. That's
cool. How about you? You have a good one?
Yeah, no, I did. I was super low key. I was watching one of my good friends. I was dog sitting for one of my good buddies. And trying to stay out of trouble. And whatever was on the docket, I just kind of went with the flow. I have a softball team that plays out of Danbury, Connecticut. And we had a little impromptu batting practice. So I just hang out with the guys and stuff like that. But yeah, that was kind of my 4th of July weekend, and wasn't too bad. So yeah, that's kind of what I did. So Bob, diving right into things here. One thing I start with my guests, usually for the most part, is, you know, kind of asking them, you know, where did you grow up? What were your early days like, childhood, everything like that? Where did you end up going to school? And, you know, what were some things in your early childhood and your early days in life that kind of led to where you ended up going, which I know was, you know, a chemist. I know you love to make things. And then from there into what you do now in Meromi.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's a big broad brush. So we can start there. So I grew up in Syracuse, New York, and my grandfather had a small farm where he grew strawberries, grew corn, potatoes, veggies, and things like that. So every summer we'd go out and we'd pick strawberries and we'd sell them at the roadside stand. And I spent most of my summers growing up doing that with my brothers. And, that's kind of where I got into, originally got into food, was just watching my grandfather grow stuff. And I've inherited a lot of that. So from there, I went to college in Syracuse as well. I went to the College of Environmental Science and Forestry in Syracuse for chemistry, natural polymer chemistry. Put myself through college by working at a local grocery store where I managed a produce department. So I worked in produce, buying produce, preparing produce, putting it out in the cases, all that good stuff, talking to customers. So I spent a lot of time around food just going through college. But I think the overall theme is, Jeff, is I just like mixing stuff together. So I always had fun making stuff growing up. So that's kind of where, you know, I think a couple paths, if you really like mixing things and creating things, so combining different elements together, one is going to being a chef and the other is going to being a chemist. And I picked the chemistry side of things, and I really enjoyed that. I thought it was a really interesting challenge to see and do experiments and figure out, well, if I combine these couple of things, what's going to happen, and can I create something that's unique and interesting. So when I got out of college, I went to work for General Electric at their R&D center in Schenectady, New York, where I was a bench chemist. So I spent the first few years of my career making things at the bench. GE had a big plastics division, and so I was a polymer chemist. So I'm basically looking at how to improve the performance of polymers for impact strength and fatigue strength and all sorts of properties, engineering properties, because we were selling into the automotive business a lot of what we called engineering plastics. Oh, wow. So that's kind of where I started out. And then I ended up moving to Detroit and working with the Detroit automakers to create, really to help them make cars, design and engineer cars, where I worked on things like instrument panels and interior trim and a whole host of different things. And that led me to Japan, because obviously if you're working on cars, you're going to eventually run into the large Japanese automakers. And right. So back in the mid 80s, Jeff, I got a chance to head over to Japan pretty early in my career. So I was probably in my early 20s.
Wow.
And got an opportunity to head over to Japan to go call on Toyota and Honda and Nissan and a bunch of their suppliers to talk to them about making, you know, different types of materials and formulating different types of plastics for their requirements. So anyway, that was the beginning of my step into Japanese culture and, you know, starting out as an industrial polymer chemist and then working from there. Now, the great thing about traveling is you get to try all sorts of food while you're doing it. And so I'm not very shy when it comes to food. And so I thought it was just wonderful to be able to go there and try all sorts of things that, you know, back in the mid 80s, probably were not that common in the US. Even like sushi was not ubiquitous like it is today. You can trip over a sushi bar today, but back in the mid 80s, you kind of had to go out of your way to go seek out a sushi experience in the United States.
And you were in your 20s.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Japan in your 20s. I remember working in New York City in my 20s and thinking that was amazing. I couldn't imagine being like, hey, head out to Japan.
Yeah, it was a blast. It was, I think, you know, if you're not shy and you're curious and you enjoy traveling and, you enjoy exploring and doing new things.
Yeah.
It's just a blast. And fortunately, you know, at the time, my boss at the time was not that outgoing.
Right.
And trying different things. And so he referred to me. He goes, I don't really want to go to Japan. Why don't you go? I'm like, yeah.
Yeah.
It was all over that.
Thank you.
So that led to a career, an international career, to foods all over the world. So I didn't stop at Japan. So eventually the automakers moved to Korea, and I helped some small automakers that are now big automakers like Kia and Hyundai, you know, get their products in production also by this time, kind of the late 80s. And, you know, they weren't that popular. Those cars weren't that popular in the U.S. They were just, you know, in a toehold at that time in the U.S. So, you know, I was heading over to Korea to help them. And I was working in Mexico to help a lot of the OEMs in the U.S. built plants in Mexico. And then eventually I ended up in China. So, so there's a whole circle of living, learning in both industrially and culturally and culinarily.
That's very interesting. Very interesting. I'm so glad I asked the question I asked, because I didn't even know that. And I think that's really cool. I mean, the fact that you were able to go over to Detroit, which was, you know, the auto capital, you know, still is. And then of course to go over to Japan and everything like that. I myself love cars, but I love cars like Formula One, IndyCar, you know, the 24-hour Le Mans. I love all that stuff. I mean, I could sit in front of a television for 24 hours and watch a race and people think I'm nuts, but, you know, Ford versus Ferrari, you know, that movie, everything like that, love that stuff. So that's super cool, Bob. That's awesome.
Oh, thanks, Jeff. Yeah. 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 I like the F1 too. Years ago, there used to be a formula race in Detroit, right in downtown Detroit. And we used to host our customers for that event, and that was a blast. We just
you would be there. That's so cool. What was that like? Talk to me about
it. It was fun. Well, actually, I took driving lessons at Skip Barber Driving School, both in Connecticut and Lime Rock, and also in Luna Sec out in California. We drive, wow, we drive a little Formula Four car. So it's a, you know, it's an open wheel,
right,
smaller version of a F1, obviously, but not quite the power, obviously. But, you know, you get around the track at top speed on a straightaway. It's around 125, but it's all in learning how to do the braking and the cornering, because you don't have to be going fast to wipe out on a, you know, track like that. Lots of curves.
Right. No, of course. I have a friend, Mike Hidalgo, who works for FCP Euro, and he's up at Lime Rock a lot and everything like that. He was actually just at Watkins Glen recently, which is super cool. And I love F1. I followed it for a few years now, and I love doing the esports, racing the F1 online with the simulator and everything like that. So much fun. I have a blast doing that.
Nice.
That on Twitch and everything. It's great. I love it. But no, that's cool. You know, working with cars and everything like that. I also know you were working with Apple. What is it you were doing with Apple?
I was working with Astics. I was living over in Shanghai when GE decided to sell that division to SABIC, Saudi Arabian company. And so we had sold. So I had an office in Shanghai, one in Tokyo, one in Seoul, and one in Bangalore. So I kind of just bounced around Asia. So I had teams of engineers in each of those locations where we did what we called application development to help our customers use our materials in different applications, and then also give feedback to our engineers to develop new materials with higher performance properties for customers. But one of our customers, a large customer of ours, was Apple. So after GE sold the division, a lot of ex-GE plastics guys were over at Apple working. And, you know, you start networking and figure out, well, what am I going to do next? And next, you know, one thing led to another, and Apple invited me to come join them to help build a supply chain for their Mac division. So what I did for a couple of years, only 2.5 years, I helped Mac build out factories in southern China, Taiwan, Japan, Korea. Most of them centered in around southern China, so Shanghai, Suzhou, Shenzhen area, Guangdong. So I built quite a few factories. I launched 15 products for Apple's over my tenure there, including all the aluminum MacBooks, MacBook Pros, you know, Apple TV, desktop stuff, displays, and that. So it was an interesting career. But as I did that, Jeff, I kind of looked at China was really transforming from what was once a pretty rural environment. So if you drove back in the day from Shanghai to Suzhou, for example, it's pretty much countryside for the whole drive. But if you were to do that drive today, it's pretty solid factories.
Wow.
So as you watch that transformation, as I watched that transformation, I started thinking about, you know, the environment and, you know, my part in what am I doing here? You know, I know I'm making a lot of great products and making a lot of good computers, but there was a piece of me that's like, I went to an environmental college. I'm like, what am I doing? So I was at that time, there was a lot of, yeah. So it's just incredible how much things transform.
Yeah.
And you watch that much, you know, green earth get turned into gray industrial buildings. You kind of wake up and go, holy shit. You know, we've got to do something. So I turned my eyes toward the renewable fuels and chemicals industry with the hope that I could start to engage in something that was more sustainable, something that was a little more environmentally friendly.
Right.
And as I did that, I was networking and talking to people. A lot of startups were looking at different schemes to come up with renewable fuels and chemicals. So all chemicals today come basically from oil from the ground. So you pump oil out and then you refine it.
Right.
And then you get various chemical streams that go into plastics, polymers, gasoline, diesel fuel, jet fuel, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And there's a bunch of plant-based oils too. So if you look at some of the major plant oils like soybean oil, corn oil, and those types of things, those are used industrially too, that go into, you know, paints and varnishes and some polymers and those types of things. So So anyway, I was looking at the renewable fuels and chemicals industry, and I teamed up with a company in San Francisco that was looking at taking algae and fermenting algae to create a source of oil. So, Jeff, if you feed anything too much food, it stores it in the form of fat. So whether it's a person, a bear, a cow, sure, or an algae, they convert excess calories into and store it in, right, in the form of, in plants in the form of oil, and animals in the form of fat. So the scheme is basically to take algae, put it in a big fermentation tank, feed it a lot of sugar, kind of simplifying, but and the algae will consume all that sugar, and they'll convert a lot of it into oil. And that oil, wow, is essentially sunflower oil. So it's a high oleic oil, which is what you would commonly get from rapeseed, canola, sunflower, you know, major seed oil crops, oil seed crops.
Right.
And so we were doing it with algae, and the fermentation scheme is similar to brewing beer. So you get a big fermentation tank, put algae in with a nutrient and sugar, and then you grow the algae, and then you extract the oil, and then you can use the oil to create fuels, food, chemicals, etc., all downstream. So that's wow, ultimately what I ended up doing. That was sort of my toehold in fermentation, was going from industrial chemistry to fermentation, sustainable chemistry. And I was looking at that fermentation scheme. You know, the technology works great. It's fine technology. The economics don't work particularly well. And that's where a lot of those companies, when we started, oil was trading at about what it is now, somewhere around $140 a barrel. But when Alberta tar sands and the Belkin fields up in North Dakota were discovered, the oil prices globally collapsed to somewhere around $40 a barrel or something like that. And so the economics for those renewable chemical companies didn't really pencil out anymore. And a lot of those companies went belly up, got out of the business, or transformed into something else altogether. So anyway, you know, after a few years of looking at sustainable fuels and chemicals and having it not really work out too well, is really looking around for something else to do, which eventually led me to the creation of Maromi, which is a small scale fermentation business aimed at local agriculture, local supply chain, you know, smaller footprint, sustainably built, organic, and, you know, just making food basically. So I think the overall scheme is just to be a little more sustainable for me personally, and to have a slightly smaller footprint on the environment. So that's what led me here.
That's awesome. Yeah. What a cool story. And what you were doing before, you know, with the algae and everything, that is so awesome. I mean, I didn't even know that you could do that. So, and create, you know, the oil and everything like that. That is really, really awesome. It's so crazy what you can do with things like that. And I do understand that it's never been more crucial right now for us to be so, you know, aware of the environment and what we're doing to it, and what we need to help to sort of reverse the effects, which, you know, might even be too late. But I'm with you. I'm big on you know, in the environment and everything like that, and anything that we can possibly do to reverse the effects of what we've had take place. So I'm glad you brought up, you know, just the environment and how important that is, because it's definitely important to me and a bunch of folks, you know, who work on the show and just who I know in general. And you know, so with Maromi, you know, with everything you've done, you decided, you know, come over to Mystic, Connecticut, wind down, sort of take this new challenge. So talk to me about you know, how you first started Maromi, how you got the, you know, your business partners, who are tremendous, and just you know, how things really got going, and of course going back to Japan and you know, going over there and learning the ways of Shoyu.
Sure. Oh yeah, it's good. It's a good question. So yeah, so let me take you through that. So I started looking around at fermentation technologies that were that I could localize here, and Shoyu really struck me as quite interesting, you know, amongst a lot of different potential technologies like making cheese and other things. But I was kind of intrigued with soy sauce, and probably I was predisposed to it because I spent so much time working in Asia. Notwithstanding, I looked at it as both really an old traditional type of fermentation, but it's also really complex. So there's an elegance in the complexity of making soy sauce that I found really attractive. So if you like, you know, again, mixing stuff together, and soy sauce for me was pretty intriguing. So I started experimenting with making small batches of soy sauce. And so I built myself a small incubator, actually staring at it right now, out of wood, heated with a light bulb with a little humidifier in it and a little temperature controller. And I started making small batches, like 5 kilogram batches of soy sauce at a time. So I was steaming beans on the stove. I was roasting wheat in the oven, grinding wheat on a little KitchenAid mill, and then fermenting in 5 gallon buckets. My daughter had gone off to college, and we're kind of empty nesters, and I turned her bedroom into fermentation central here. So I had 5 gallon buckets pretty much covering her entire floor of her bedroom in different formulations. So I just started making batch after batch after batch after batch of the same thing. So it's I go back to my chemistry roots. It's like, well, how do you control this? So how do you make good koji? What's the right way to steam beans? What's the right way to roast wheat? What's the right grinding? How do you do the salt water to bean ratio when you're in the barrel fermentation? So koji's making soy sauce, is a two-stage fermentation. So one is making koji, and then two is fermenting it in a barrel with salt water. Which is that solution, that mash, is actually the namesake of the company. It's called Maromi in Japanese. It means mash. And so I had barrels of mash Maromi all over the house here. And I started pressing it, and I built a press, a Dutch lever press, it's called. So it's a weighted one end, and you squeeze the mash to get the raw soy sauce out. And so I started squeezing soy sauce and refining soy sauce, tasting soy sauce, and I came up with what I thought was some pretty good soy sauce. And so I reached out to my now business partner, James Wayman.
James Wayman. So I've heard so much about. So many people have said, you got to get James on, and I've reached out to him, and I'm hoping he'll join us later on season three. That would be awesome. But
That'd be fun. So James was executive chef at a local restaurant.
Oyster Club.
I reached out to him on Instagram and asked him, hey, I'm making soy sauce. Would you be interested in trying it? And being a curious guy that he is, he's like, yeah, sure, bring it on down. So I brought him down some soy sauce that I thought was pretty respectable. And, he tried it. And he's like, hey, it's pretty interesting. And, it's a far cry from like industrial soy sauce. It's a lot more flavor elements going on in what I was producing than what you might get out of a bottle of something you pick up in a grocery store, grocery aisle in the US. So that got us started on a path to have a conversation, and that eventually led to us establishing Maromi as a company. So my partners with Maromi today are my wife and partner, Debbie Michiko Florence, who's also a children's book author.
I was going to say, your wife is an author of over 20 children's books. That's awesome. Yes.
Yeah, she is. Yeah, she's pretty prolific. I'm very proud of her.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so Debbie and James and I are the three partners in Maromi. After James had give me a nod, and he started incorporating it into some dishes that he was making. And every once in a while, Maromi soy sauce would make it onto the menu as a supplier. And I was so proud of that. It was like amazing. So I was literally selling like maybe 5 bottles of soy sauce at a time at a month, very limited supply.
Right.
I took that, and I sat down and I wrote to the CEOs of 15 soy sauce manufacturers in Japan. So I wrote them emails and I said, "Hey, I'm Bob. I make soy sauce here. I'll be in Japan, and I was wondering if you'd be interested in, talking to me about soy sauce, and I'd like you to see if you'd be interested in trying my soy sauce." So of the 15 CEOs, three of them said, "Sure, come on over." And so I booked a ticket. I went over to Japan with my soy sauce samples, and
that's so.
It was a lot of fun. So I went on a little tour of soy sauce makers, and I didn't pick the big ones. I picked sort of middle sized to small artisanal soy makers intentionally, because I think, so there's like 1700 or so soy sauce makers in Japan.
I feel like you wouldn't want the mass produced because it's just routine. You know, you want the ones who really spend the time and work, you know, put that effort in.
Yeah, well, I knew that there were, because I'd spent so much time in Japan, I knew that there were a lot of different varieties of soy sauce. Let's say, maybe not varieties is not the right word, but different manufacturers of soy sauce that were making really interesting and tasty soy sauce.
If you were to, real quick, if you were to guess, how many soy sauce manufacturers do you think there are? Is there a lot?
It's like, I think the number's close to 1,700, Jeff.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, of which, you know, two are like 90% of the market, I think.
Gotcha. Very interesting. Okay, thank you for that. Thanks.
You're welcome. So, of this kind of the mid-tier and the small soy sauce manufacturers in Japan, they're making some pretty, I think, really interesting soy sauce flavors that I think have better flavor profiles, let's say more interesting flavor profiles. And so that's what I was pursuing, is more of this craft artisanal type of soy sauce than an industrial type of soy sauce. And so I was fortunate enough to befriend the CEO of Chiba Shoyu in Chiba, Japan, as the name implies. So Chiba is a huge soy sauce region in Japan. It's just west of Tokyo. It's between Narita Airport, if you've ever flown into Tokyo, in downtown Tokyo. So it's in the Tokyo metropolitan area, if you will. In fact,
gotcha.
Tokyo Disney is in Chiba, not in Tokyo. So, but anyway, I went over to Chiba Shoyu, and Iida-san, the CEO, he's also like fifth generation co-owner of the company. We sat around, we talked about soy sauce making, tasted my soy sauce. They took samples back to the lab and tore it apart and gave me feedback on the composition. And I got to ask a lot of questions around the techniques and art. And I got to spend a lot of time in the factory looking at how they were making things and what types of ingredients they were using, and what types of koji they were using, et cetera. And so that was just an eye-opener, great visit. I still send samples of my new products and new production to Iida-san, and we chat back and forth constantly on different questions. In fact, he came here just before the pandemic and visited me making soy sauce at my house here in Mystic. and so he and one of his engineers, Hoshina-san, so we spent a little bit of time here, and you know, helping me critique my process and helping me to perfect how I was making soy sauce. So they've been just great mentors and great technical advisors, and continue to be just huge friends of ours and of me personally. So as soon as we can get back over, we're going to plan another trip shortly and get back over there and, you know, just continue the dialogue. So that's a lot of fun. In fact, on my website, there's a link to
a video
that he did, but there's also a link to an article that was an interview that was done by the Japanese Ministry of Trade has a division called Cool Japan, which is to promote Japanese cultural elements worldwide.
That's so cool.
And so there's a link to an article that I was interviewed for, as well as Iida-san, Chiba Shoyu, that's translated roughly into English, but you can get in there and take a look at that link and read all about it. It's an interesting article about soy sauce making and then my relationship with Chiba Shoyu. That's a lot of fun. So one of these days in the not too distant future, we'll get an opportunity to go back over and under invitation from the cool Japan folks as well as Chiba Shoyu to continue the adventure.
That is so cool, and it is totally an adventure. And for those who are listening or like, where can I watch that? Where can I see all this, what you're talking about? Go to moromishoyu.com, which is Thank you so much for listening to part one of a two-part podcast episode with my friend from Moromi, the great Bob Florence. Stay tuned next week for part two and a continuation from where we left off. Yet again, another episode of Sweeten Up is in the books. Thank you so much for listening. Be sure to rate, review, and subscribe anywhere you get your podcasts. We would greatly appreciate your feedback and support. A huge thanks, as always, to my best friends, the guys who make it all possible, post-production and music, Morgan Lutzi, production and art director, Kurt Vinci, editor and writer, Nick Passacretta, and of course, a special thanks as always to Devin Cipelli, who recently got engaged. Congrats, buddy. As I said at the top, stay tuned for part two of my conversation with the sauce master extraordinaire, Bob Florence. We covered so much more in part two, and you do not want to miss out on this one. But until then, you know the deal. Stay safe, stay healthy, love you all. Peace.